Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in hearing how a successful entrepreneur transitions into multifamily real estate investing, you are going to want to hear what Dan Hanford has to share. Dan went to chiropractic school, started a business leveraging other people in multiple locations. He then started to invest in multifamily and has over $350 million in assets under management. His latest deal was over a $20 million capital raise. This guy is always looking to challenge himself to get to the next level. And along the way, he helps grow the wealth of his many, many trusted investors. Before we jump into the intro, I want to thank all of you. We launched the podcast just a few months ago, and we already have over 250 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts. This has been amazing and so much fun. If you are enjoying the podcast, I've got a big ask for you. Can you please send out a share with a link to your favorite episode on your social media? That's right. Actually, share the podcast with all your followers on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube, wherever. This is your chance and your opportunity to take action and help others get exposed to the wealth-building impact of real estate. I thank you in advance for what you're about to do. Now, on to the intro.
Welcome to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing, be introduced to the players that are getting it done, and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darren Batchelder.
A little background on Dan Hanford before we start the show. Dan grew up and focuses much of his investment attention in the Carolinas. He's married with four kids ranging from 2 to 10 years old. This guy built a very successful business, then started to invest in multifamily. He has over $350 million in assets under management and wants to grow that to over $1 billion. In addition, he's dedicated his time and effort to help educate others. He developed a website called PassiveInvesting.com with resources for passive investors. He started a Facebook group called Multifamily Investor Nation that has over 31,000 members. He started an online multifamily conference called MFIN Summit and can be found at MFINSummit.com, where he has leaders in the multifamily space speaking from all across the country. In addition to all of this, he also has a podcast. I can't wait to see what this guy does next. Now, on to the show. Hello, everyone. Today, we've got a special guest with us today. We've got Dan Hanford on the line. So, Dan, I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Glad to be here, Darren. Looking forward to sharing with your audience here.
Fantastic. So, the way that Dan and I know each other, we actually ran into each other at a multifamily conference, and I don't even know if you remember this, but we bumped into each other in the hallway. We talked for just a short bit, and then next thing you know, he's inviting me to go to dinner with him and a bunch of big time multifamily guys and girls. And for one reason or another, I already had a conflict. I wasn't able to attend that, which looking back on it, I wish I had, and I would have met some great people. But after I got my first syndication deal, Dan was kind enough to ask me onto his podcast. And so he was the first podcast that I was a guest on, and he kind of showed me the ropes. So I'm glad to have him on here today. Dan, if you could just start out by sharing how many properties, how many units are you currently invested in?
Well, the number just went up last Friday. So I think the total number right now, I could probably pull it up on our website real quick. I think we're, as far as the number of properties, we're on, I think number 11 or 12. But as far as like the total number of doors and like the total portfolio value, right now we're right about 360 million portfolio wise and right about 2,600 doors, or a little over 2,600, almost 2,700 doors altogether.
Which that is an amazing number in itself. But then that is all on the GP side. You're also invested in a ton of passive deals as well, aren't you?
That's correct. That's correct. My wife and I invest passively in other operators to kind of fill our own LP bucket, if you will, to be able to invest in other assets. And pull it up right now. We're right. The current right now is we're almost at 7,000 doors on our LP portfolio, which is right about 6,900. And then number of deals is right about 3,132. So
that's incredible. That's those are both huge numbers. So before you got into multifamily investing, you know, what was your career path prior to that?
Well, I'm actually a chiropractor by trade, and I actually own a couple of different businesses. The very first one that I have is one that I started while I was going through chiropractic college. There's a whole story on that one, so we can get into that in just a little bit too. But started out in chiropractic college, started my first business while I was in there. And then when I got out, I was able to start my chiropractic clinics debt-free because of that business. Wow. And then I was from there, I actually started to integrate my chiropractic clinics into a medical clinic. So we started to do, it was called an MDDC clinic, where we integrated the medical doctors, the nurse practitioners with our chiropractors. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I just made the executive decision to remove the chiropractic services so we can really focus on the medical side of the business, so we can also expand from just one clinic. And now today we actually have 4 non-surgical orthopedic medical clinics. And we do a lot of advanced procedures like prolotherapy, PRP, and stem cell treatments for orthopedic conditions. And then we also do a lot of injection-based therapies for just arthritic conditions as well.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you still have those businesses?
Yes, I do.
And so how do you kind of split your time between the business side and the multifamily investment side?
Sure. Well, I have a really good team that supports me.
So
I actually, kind of stepped away from the full-time management of the clinics probably about going on 3 years now. And during the business hours, I actually haven't stepped foot in those clinics at all. So I have a good kind of CEO that runs everything. When I made the transition to doing the real estate full time, I actually had to reach out to my COO, and I promoted him to the CEO because he had been with us for a while and knew all of the stuff that we had done and the growth that we had had. And I knew he could take us to the next level. And so I stepped away to focus on the real estate, mainly from a tax perspective, to help reduce my taxable liability from the income we were generating off the clinics. But the other business that I have, which is actually called shopanatomical.com, it is a online company, and we sell all types of anatomy models like skeletons and skulls and brains and hearts. And that particular business has been running on its own for quite some time now, and I have a team that runs that as well. So as far as time component, you asked about like what's my time involved with that. I have a corporate meeting with my team once a month. And where we get together, strategize, talk about the metrics of the business, and kind of see what we need to do to pivot and change, make some high level decisions. But the day to day has been delegated to other people. And that's one lesson that I learned early on in my career, is that in order for me to be able to have the growth and the scale that I wanted, I needed to get out of my own head, because I'm the type of person that feels like I can do everything better than everybody else. And it's one of those things where when I say it, I'm like, do I really think that way, But anybody who's listening who is an entrepreneur or owns their own business, they have that problem sometimes where they don't want to give up certain tasks. And that's where I was. I wanted to do everything, but I knew I had to delegate in order for me to grow. And so I had to play a little bit of a mind trick with myself, where I would say, if I could replace what I'm doing right now and have somebody else doing it for me, and they can do it 80 to 85% as well as I can do it, then I would be able to step away from that and focus on the vision and the growth of the actual business itself. And most of the time, people surprise me. They do it a lot better than I could have ever done, right?
That's a great surprise to have happen, right?
Yes. And it's nice because, and one of the other things I learned early on is that I tried to replace myself with people that were not really as experienced in doing that. And I just bought the, I didn't buy, I guess I'm buying them, but I just hired the cheapest labor, right? And I got what I paid for, right? But now, you know, I learned that if I can hire the right people and pay them really well, then they're going to be loyal, they're going to stick around, and they're actually going to perform better in that specific role as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. I had one guy on a few weeks ago, and he wanted to take over a property manager and said, you know, hey, what would it take to keep you on? And she said, you know, pay me a dollar more. And he's like, how's two or three? You know, and I said, how long has she stayed with you? And he's like, it's probably been like 20 years now. Like, you know, so it was well worth paying her, you know, more than she even asked to get that loyalty. And so what you said, though, you started out as a chiropractor by trade. Now, most chiropractors that I've come across, they come out of school and their goal is to open one office that they are going to be the chiropractor for. And then maybe they'll grow by bringing on junior chiropractors in that office. How did you, you know, have that mindset shift that you didn't want to do that, that you wanted to actually build multiple locations and have somebody, you know, another CEO run it?
Well, it kind of probably starts back before I even went into chiropractic school, and where before I even went into chiropractic, I already had the business side of running a clinic down, and I really only needed the clinical component of it. So I already kind of knew that right out of school, I wanted to start my own clinic. I didn't want to do what's called an associateship or, you know, internship, whatever, and work for another chiropractor first. I wanted to just go out on my own because my wife's uncle is actually a chiropractor, and that's actually how we met. And I was working for him for 4 years while I was working on my undergrad and in biology from the University of South Carolina. And so I worked for him for 4 years learning how to do insurance and billing and working with patients and trafficking the patients and documentation and a lot of the back end administrative duties that have to do with running a clinic and then running a business. And so when I was in chiropractic school, I didn't have to worry about that because I knew I already had all that down. Right. And so when I got out, I started off right away. Now, in the beginning, I had no desire for multiple clinics. You know, I'd always heard horror stories about that. And, you know, it just wasn't something that I really wanted to go down. But about 2 or 3 years into my, you know, working in as for myself as the clinic owner and seeing patients is that I couldn't go on vacation without it costing me money.
Right.
Because when you're the dancing bear, you know, I always call these things like the chiropractic business is a dancing bear business where if you stop dancing, then guess what? You stop earning money, right? The revenue goes down. So I was going in every day being that dancing bear. And if I want to go on vacation for a week with my wife and our family, well, guess what? I still had to pay my staff. I still had to pay all my overhead, but I had no income coming in because no patients were being seen. And so that really kind of was the light bulb moment for me that I really wanted to hire on associate chiropractors to work for me. And so I started to hire on the associate chiropractors to work for me and then actually went to a conference a couple years later after that, where I learned about how I could integrate the medical side of things into my clinic and started to hire on a medical doctor. And then we ended up growing from, you know, just the one clinic to the four clinics in about a 2 year period of time. And we were really able to kind of scale and grow once we got through some of the growing pains of that second growth clinic, because the second clinic was actually the hardest clinic to grow. But once we got all the systems down and the processes down in that second clinic, we were easily able to open up that third and the fourth one without any issues and be profitable fairly quickly and also stay debt-free in all the clinics too.
That makes sense. And, you know, I think it's an important lesson because, I mean, there's also people look at franchises, right? And I've heard people that have purchased a franchise and one franchise location, and all of a sudden they end up, it's like they bought themselves a job. They're in that franchise every day. They're working crazy hours. And the people that I've heard that really have built wealth from franchises go in with the mindset that I'm going to own 10 or 15 or 20 franchises and hire managers, competent managers to run them. And so you figure that out in terms of growing the business. And I think that parlays into, you know, getting into real estate investing too. I mean, you're really focused on large scale multifamily, and you know, I wouldn't say that you have to start in large scale multifamily, but it definitely offers the ability to scale, where, you know, if you start small, you'll learn that you get bogged down in the day to day and it's hard to really scale. So talk to us about, you know, when you did start getting into multifamily, how did you start? Did you start in residential, small scale multifamily, or did you go big right away?
So that was a decision process that I had to go through in the beginning, because I had stepped away from my clinics to be able to focus on the real estate side of things from a tax perspective. And, you know, when I first got started, I was like, I want to go look at some of these, you know, kind of maybe some rentals or some duplexes or some smaller multifamilies. And I even remember, you know, reminiscing back to when I first had these thoughts of going and touring a 12 unit, you know, and going and touring some of these smaller properties.
Sure.
And I didn't even know what I was doing at that time. You know, I'm just like going out there touring and, you know, being an investor, if you will. And very glad I didn't do that, because one of the things that I learned is that I had already been down a path of success up to that point. And then I had grown to a certain point as well. And I didn't really want to feel like I was starting back at square one again and trying to start on the small level. And so started doing some additional research and then, you know, found a mentor that's I've been with since the very beginning that has helped me get to where I am today. And that's one of the things I always recommend to people is find somebody that can mentor you, that can reduce that learning curve. Because the very first property that we bought on our own was an $8.9 million property. And we just kind of scaled and grew from there, right? Because, you know, the one we just closed last week was a $57.6 million property. So it's a big, big jump from that. And that's actually our third, like almost $50 million deal. We had one earlier this year at $49.955 million. We had another one last year at $51.5 million. So we're just, you know, constantly improving our investor relations process and improving things. But that mentor has been really instrumental in helping us get to the point of where we are today. And so that's kind of what I did in the very beginning is I hired a mentor, but I hired a mentor that I had direct access to. So I'm not a big fan of getting a mentor that basically, or a coaching group that has their students coaching. I'm just not a big fan of that. So I wanted to find a mentor that I could have access to them. And I wanted to make sure that they were currently and actively acquiring properties right now in the current market. Not that they used to do it 15 years ago or 5 years ago. I wanted them to be actively acquiring properties themselves, not just they're helping their students do it. And so found that mentor. And even today, that person is still acquiring properties today. And awesome. Actually invest alongside some of those properties as well on the LP side, even today. And so that's kind of the process we went through. But once I hired that mentor, one of the things I did is I partnered with two other groups to be able to help them take down some properties. And that did a couple of things for me. It allowed me to be able to build my credibility with the sellers, but also build credibility with the brokers. So when I go to try to talk to them about other projects, even though I hadn't taken down a deal myself yet or our group, I was able to take down the next deal because I had that credibility kind of built in, and we could actually kind of acquire properties moving forward. And then as you start to close more deals, that credibility builds up. And, you know, two of the last three deals that we've bought were truly off-market deals where it was a former seller that we had already bought from before. They knew we could execute. They knew we could close. And we even now still get awarded deals where we're not the highest bidder, but we have that confidence of being able to close and not being difficult to deal with and not trying to always retrade on some of the piddly items.
Yeah, that's great. You know, so for the listeners, you know, there's people that are experienced, there's people that are looking just to get into the space. One of the things that he said, I think is very key is look, we all started with no investment properties. We all started with no units, you know? So, you know, give yourself a little bit of slack. And, you know, when you think about touring that, you know, 12 unit property, you know, you didn't know what you were doing, but you were, you know, you learned along the way. I was in the same boat. I only got involved 3 years ago and I went and bought a duplex. I bought a new construction duplex, and people are like, are you bummed out that you did that? I'm like, well, it got me in the game. You know, once I signed the contract, it, you know, got me over the emotional hump of actually getting into real estate. And, but then I realized I really wanted to scale and go bigger. So, you know, for the listeners, look, if you need to start small and that's where your mindset is, then do that and then learn how to scale. But know that you can go, you know, along a whole long spectrum. You can go larger, but two things he said, one, you need to really find a mentor that can coach you along the way. And then two, if you want to go larger, you're going to need to partner with people that have experience, or else you're just not going to get awarded the deal. So talk about this, this large one, this 50 some odd, that must have been a pretty big capital raise.
It was a $21.49 million raise. So
you know exactly what it was.
Yes. No, it's one of those things where, I mean, when I look at it right now, I think, you know, $21.49 million. I mean, we took down properties that were, the purchase price was less than that, you know?
Right, exactly.
Now we're raising equity for more than that purchase price from before. And so, but, you know, I think, you know, the process that we put into place from our investor relations piece is that we don't just treat our investors as a number. We don't want them to just come under our fold and just like feel like they're not related to us, right? We want to have that true relationship with our investors. And we go out of our way and do a lot of different things to make sure we can maintain that relationship as well.
So what do you do to you know, foster that relationship?
Sure. So, you know, first off, every investor that comes through and they go to our website, passiveinvesting.com, on the top right-hand corner, there's a page or a button that says, you know, join the Passive Investor Club. And when they fill out that form, my assistant will call them and try to get them on the phone and schedule them on my calendar. And she will schedule them on my calendar to kind of have an introductory call. If for some reason she can't get a hold of them, then she will send them an email. First, she'll leave them a voicemail saying that she's going to send the email. And then she'll send out the email saying, you know, here's a link to his calendar. If any of these times don't work, please let me know and I can get you scheduled with him on a different time or day. But these are the times that he has available. Like he has just like open times that you can actually, you know, call, have a conversation. And I want to jump on a phone call with them. You know, right now we're doing a lot of 506 Charlies. So we're able to advertise, but we can only accept accredited investors. But and we don't have to have these conversations with them. But because it's an investor relations process, that high touch process, I think, is what has allowed us to be so successful, is that we try to go out of our way to make sure we have conversations with them, because the more that they can get to know us, the more trust they're going to have built up into us, that we're going to be able to help them, you know, and want to invest with us when we have that next property. And then after every phone call that I have with an investor, I pull out my iPhone and I program their number and their name into my phone. And one thing that, you know, I do that's unique is after every phone call, I will send them a text message with my contact card, which has all of my information in it. And basically, I just say, it was a pleasure speaking with you over the phone. If you have any questions for me in the future, here's my contact card. So you have easy access to me. Feel free to reach out to me if you have any questions. Glad to help. Right.
That's great.
And it's a personal, it's from my personal cell phone. Right.
Right.
So I know some people are like, oh, I don't want to give my personal cell to my investors. I'm like, why not? If you want them to be able to trust you and give you the, you know, millions of dollars that you want to be able to control, you I mean, why not? Right. I mean, and I'll tell you, I give every investor that I talk to my phone number, and I very rarely get phone calls from them. Every once in a while during an offering, when we're raising money or whatever, I might get a text message question or something like that. But I rarely ever get phone calls, and we're talking like thousands of investors that are in my phone.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one of the other things that I do when I program them in my phone is in the company field, I put in the word investor. And then right after it, I put the city and state of where they're located. And the reason why this is important is that when I'm traveling around and I'm saying I'm going to go travel to Dallas or Tampa or Miami, I can actually type into my phone and my contacts the city name, and all of my investors in that city will pop up. And I can personally send them a text message and say, hey, I'm coming to town on this date. I'm putting together an investor dinner. Would love to have you join us. You know, are you available? Right.
Wow. That's great.
High level, kind of high touch kind of process to be able to, you know, make sure you continue to have that relationship with the investors.
That's fantastic. That's a great idea. That's a great idea. Talk about mindset, because when you're in the beginning, you know, you're raise was significantly less than $21.49 million. But as you gain more experience, you know, it gets larger and larger. And, you know, you have to, in your own mind, believe that you're, you know, competent enough and that you have something valuable to offer other people. You know, talk about how you kind of grew your mindset to allow yourself to grow.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of it has to do with making sure that we're getting into the right properties, because I do get investors asking me that, like, how do you sleep well at night knowing that, like, in 2020, we'll have raised a little over $60 million from investors. And so how do you sleep well at night knowing that you have $60 million worth of investors' money inside of your properties? And it's an easy answer. It's because we are confident with the properties and the assets that we're acquiring. You know, we're not going to go into an asset that I wouldn't put my own personal money in. And I'm usually the largest investor in our properties. Because again, the reason why I got into this business is because the cash flow that I was getting off the clinics, I needed to be able to invest it to be able to get that depreciation benefit to be able to offset those taxes. And so I don't want to put my own money in something if, and I certainly don't want to put another investor's money in it if I won't put my own money into it. And it's a constant question that even Brandon on our team, who does all of our acquisitions, he's one of our other managing partners. He contacts me sometimes and says, hey, before he even looks at a deal, he's like, hey, I think this one might be a good deal. Here's kind of the submarket. Here's the area. And it's used to me, I can usually tell by just like the market as to whether or not I want him to go after it. Right. And I'm like, yes, let's give that one a try. We'll look at it. Or I'll be like, no, I can't put my money there. I don't want to bring my investors into there. Nothing. Right. And so it's a constant process going back and forth with the acquisitions team to make sure that we're acquiring the properties that we know are going to be able to sustain, you know, economic recessions, but also be able to, you know, cash flow for many, many years.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I think that has to happen is, you know, some people, especially when they're first getting in the syndication space, they look at it as like, I need this much money to get this deal done, you know, versus really, it's you know you're presenting an opportunity to, like you said, you fully believe that you're going to grow your wealth with the money that you're putting in the deal. So you're going to help all those other people grow their wealth, and why would you not want to present that opportunity to people? You know, so it's a different way of looking at things.
It's definitely not a sales process at all, and I think some groups that try to play it off as a sales process, it comes across as like the syndicator needs you, right? And even though I need my investors to be able to acquire these properties, I never want to have the portrayal to our investors that we are desperate and we need their money in order to close, right?
Right.
So if an investor calls up and they say, hey, I know I committed, you know, $200,000 to be able to invest in your property, to me that I just don't think the deal makes sense, or I don't think it fits my criteria, or, you know, whatever excuse they give you, I don't try to, like, you know, backtrack that and second effort it and anything like that. I'm just like, no problem. I completely understand. I'll keep you on the list for some of the future properties. And, you know, maybe there's a one down the road that might be a good fit for you, you know? And so it's not a, you know, oh, come on, Dan, like, really, you think this is gonna be this and this, try to like be like a sales type piece of it. Cause that to me comes across as more of like, hey, I need you, Darren, or I can't close this property. And I don't ever want to have that feeling. I don't want our investors to ever feel that way as well.
No, that's great. That's great. Another thing I saw that you did, I don't know if you've been doing this on all your deals, but I did see it on one of your more recent deals, is that you offered multiple classes to the limited partners. So, you know, as you grew, you probably realized, you know, some investors have, you know, a different goal in mind, and, you know, they'd rather have a higher cash on cash, but, you know, give up some of the upside on the back end, and other investors, you know, want to be able to share in that. And so they'll take a lower cash on cash. So I saw that you actually structured two different classes. Talk about that and why you did that, and how that has been perceived by your investor database.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, I think a lot, especially in 2020, there's been a lot of people that are uncertain about kind of where the market's going to go over the next, you know, 6 to 9 to 12 months, however it may be. And so being able to give them options like this helps them to be able to kind of diversify their risks. And sometimes if they want, they can do a blended approach where they can invest in both classes, like a class A and a class B investment, where they have this kind of blended return, but it's also a blended risk profile within the same investment. But people who are you know, kind of less risk averse and they want to really, you know, have more cash flows, like you said, that's where that class A comes in. And that class A is in a lower position in the capital stack, closer to the debt, which means they actually have a higher priority when it comes to paying out, whether it be cash flows or when we go to sell the property. And so because of that lower risk, they do give up some of that potential for the upside, but they get that preferred return in ours around that 9%. That's an annualized return that's preferred that they get paid out on a monthly basis based on the cash flows off the property. And then, of course, the Class B investor is the traditional, you know, 70-30 split. They're going to get their preferred return of usually 7 or 8%, somewhere around in there. And then they're going to have the potential for the upside gain as well. And of course, that upside gain changes depending on the property itself and, you know, the different metrics of the returns and stuff. And I wrote an article actually on this topic and posted it on our website. So for your listeners, if they want, they can go to passiveinvesting.com and we have a knowledge center on there, and you just type in equity structures or whatever. And the article will come up there, and there's some illustrations kind of showing capital stack structures as well as this kind of dual tier, you know, equity structure from the LP perspective, because I felt like it was really important for our investors to understand where they sat in the capital stack, so they understood their risk profiles, but also kind of why there were, you know, the returns there were in that particular position. And this is another level on our investor relations piece that I kind of didn't mention is once a month we actually have an actual printed snail mail newsletter that we mail out to our investors every single month. And our investors, we get a lot of great feedback from it because we try to write articles in there that our investors would want to know about. So this topic that we're talking about right now, I wrote an article in one of our newsletters this year about that. I wrote one on, you know, what's the difference between a preferred return and preferred equity, and, you know, kind of, you know, what are the different nuances of preferred returns. And there's a lot of different topics that we try to write on that really questions that I get from investors that I know are common questions, and to try to help them and educate them on exactly, you know, what they're investing in. And that article was actually one that was originally posted in that newsletter that we decided to put it into a blog article. But that's another thing that we do, is we send out that printed newsletter for our investors. And I'm not the only one that writes in there. It's actually a 12-page newsletter.
Nice. Oh, wow.
It's professionally printed. And each one of our partners writes, we have three of us, each one of us writes an article about something that we're working on. And then we have an investor profile in there, or an investor interview, where someone on my team actually interviews one of our investors and talks about their background and how they got to where they are now and their experience working with us. And then we also have like a market, you know, kind of survey or market update on each one of some of the markets that we're actually acquiring properties in. And then we'll put a few other articles in there based on some of the other things. Like earlier this year, we did a demographic study of kind of where all of our investors are from, you know, from all the investments. We have almost 1,000 investors that are actively invested inside of our properties. And we did a survey to figure out, you know, what's the number one state and or the top three states that are invested in there, from the number of investors, also by the dollar amount of invested and things like that. And so we try to provide a lot of information there in those newsletters. But one of the other things that we do with those mailing addresses, because we have the actual physical mailing addresses of our investors, is every offering that we put out, we actually print out a full high gloss, you know, perfect bound, I don't want to call it a brochure, but the offering memorandum is printed up and it is hard mailed to each one of those investors as well via priority mail. So I can make sure that they actually are aware and know of that offering as well. Because in our email system, we use a software called ActiveCampaign, and it allows us to kind of keep track of a lot of metrics. And we have about a 52 to 53% open rate, which is actually really good compared to like,
right. That's great. Yeah.
I think part of it is because it's a very cultivated list, but we're also very deliberate about sending out emails on a fairly consistent basis as well.
That's fantastic. So, you know, that leads me to, you know, when you started out, you started out with, you know, a certain network, but then as you got into bigger deals, your equity raise goes up and you have the need to, you know, bring in more and more people into the fold. So, you've done a lot of unique things. You're a great business guy. I mean, like you came into the investing world. You had already done, the business side in the medical field. And so now you get into the real estate side and you realize you got to, you know, how do I get out to more people? How do I attract more people? How do we partner with more people? And so you started up this passiveinvesting.com, which is a great name to have. I mean, it is exactly what it is. And then you started up Multifamily Investor Nation. And I think you have like something crazy, like over 30,000 members.
I do.
Of that. I mean, that's crazy. And with COVID, there's a ton of conferences that are online, but you were the first conference that I know of that really was like an all online multifamily conference. You know, there were a bunch of conferences going on all over the country. And then, you know, you said to yourself, well, at least I think you said to yourself, how do I differentiate, you know, myself from these other conferences? And so you put together an online one, fully online. And what that provided was a low cost alternative for people to log on and learn the business. It also offered a lot of different speakers the ability to, you know, be a part of that, where they may not have been able to fly to your location to do your conference and speak at your conference, but they can log on for an hour or two and be a speaker from that. So talk about your thought process in developing that and the success of that, and how have you been getting investors through that network?
So when I first got started in that kind of thought process of putting that together, I doing some of this stuff in the chiropractic side of things, I actually have done a live event before where I did some consulting in that space and absolutely hated it. Like, I just did not really?
Like it.
I liked the speaking aspect of it and like, you know, getting in front of people and kind of sharing my knowledge and experience and stuff like that. But the nuances of like putting an event together, I have no desire to do that ever again.
Gotcha. And so you participating in it, you liked, but it was the planning of it and all that. Because look, you're a personable guy and an outgoing guy. And whenever you're someplace, you're always trying to pull more people in and get to know more people. So that surprised me at first, but
yeah. No, I just don't like the and there's also a lot of risk involved with a live event. And then most people who do a live event, they lose money on the ticket sales, but they make money by selling a coaching program on the back end that's like, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. And I have no desire to do that either. So right. People ask me all the time, you know, do you do any coaching or mentoring? I'm like, no, but I know some people that do, you know, and I'll like refer them over to various people that I know that do some of that stuff. But, you know, to me, I feel like that's another reason why we've been able to succeed as well as we have, is that we've stayed focused on the true acquisitions and building the investor relations piece of our business, instead of trying to muddy the waters a little bit with trying to bring on students and coaching and things like that. But when I first started that event, in November, we decided to do it, and I wanted to do the event in December, and I was talking to somebody about it.
So you wanted to turn around in a month?
I did. that's kind of how I am. I'm helping out with some stuff in my church right now, and I'm having a little bit of pushback from one of the members of the church on some of the stuff that's been there for 20 years. And my pastor, I was talking to him yesterday. He goes, well, Dan, he goes, you're like the helicopter. You like to fly in, swoop down, get it done, and then fly out. He said, this other person is like a B-52 bomber. He needs a long runway to get in and land and, you know, get the things done, and then like have a long runway to take off. And so there's two different types of perspectives there. And so, but I had somebody tell me, like, don't do it in December, push it off till like February. And I was like, nope, I'll meet you in the middle. I'm going to do it in January. So we did our first one in January 2019. And getting ready to have our fifth one. We do one in January and June of every year. And so this one coming up is going to be in January, January 21st, 22nd, and 23rd.
And where can listeners find information on that one? Because there, listeners, I got to tell you, the amount of speakers that he has on this conference is unbelievable. And if you haven't been able to, you know, afford to go to a multifamily conference and, you know, fly there and pay for a hotel, and or you're just not that committed yet, you just, but you do want to learn, this is a you know, very affordable way to do it. And you get access to so many different syndicators that are teaching on all kinds of different subjects.
So if your listeners want to check out more information on that, they can go to MFINsummit.com. So MFIN just stands for Multifamily Investor Nation. So MFINsummit.com, and I have the speaker schedule there. You kind of see the entire, you know, kind of schedule of events. And it's also in 2021, we're actually putting a lot of networking and a component to this as well. We've actually are launching a new app, which I'm sure you probably have seen on some of these other live in-person events, and even some of the virtual ones lately have been using it, which is the Hoova app. So it actually allows for a lot more networking opportunities with other people that are attending the events. So you have a little more access to people to be able to continue that networking. And one of the other questions that you asked me, Darren, which I didn't answer yet, was about, am I getting investors from it, right?
Yeah, right.
So one of the main impetuses behind trying to kind of create I don't want to say coaching, but an educational platform, because we have one component of it that we charge for, I guess two if you call the MFIN Summit one, but we do a weekly webinar every single week, and we've been doing that consistently now for, you know, several years, a couple of years now. And we are consistent with that. We try to come up with topics that people are interested about, especially new people, right? Because there's a lot of people that are new in this space that they think that they want to get started doing this, and then they dive deep into it and they go, holy moly, this is a lot of work. I don't want to mess with this. Here, Dan, here's my money. You do it, right?
Right.
And I also get, so that's one side of it, but then I also get people that come into our investments that are active syndicators. I mean, you'd be surprised, Darren, if I was to mention names, and I won't mention them for, you know, obvious reasons, but
sure.
There are a lot of well-known syndicators that invest alongside us in our properties because they have a 401k or an IRA, and they can't invest in their own properties. So they know our group, and they know that we have that built-in kind of credibility and trust, and they invest with their own money inside of our properties. And so that piece of it is obviously more is really powerful as well. One of the things I was going to mention to you is one of the things that we do is we keep track of our number of investors that we get into our website on like a rolling 30-day basis. And of course, when we first got started, it was maybe like, you know, 3, 4, 5, somewhere around in there. But, you know, now if I look at it today, I'm going to pull that real time. This changes every day, but because it's a rolling 30 days, it's not like just during the month of November or the month of October. We have 157 contacts that have come to our website, filled out the form and said that they want to invest with us in the last 30 days.
That's incredible.
And that's straight off of our active campaign software.
That's incredible, really is. And you know, the other thing is that some people may, you know, even you mentioned that you have syndicators in your deals, and some of it is because they're, you know, doing 401k and IRA money that they can't invest in their own deal. But otherwise, they may be focused on a different market too, and they want to, you know, they want to diversify. So share with the listeners kind of the markets that you are focused on.
We're primarily focused on the Carolinas, because that's where I'm located, is here in Columbia, South Carolina. So in the North Carolina side, we focus in the Charlotte MSA and then the Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill kind of triangle area. And on the South Carolina side, we focus on the Greenville, South Carolina MSA, and then Charleston, South Carolina. And then over the last couple of months, we've been kind of looking and dabbling into the Atlanta, Georgia MSA, as well as the Jacksonville, Florida MSA.
Got it. So, I mean, if you have syndicators in Arizona or Texas, and they know that submarket very well, but they want to diversify a little bit and get some East Coast presence, you know, you've got a great reputation and a great process and proven track record. So it's a great way for them to get some diversification. I'm going to, you know, shift gears a little bit here.
Sure.
Where did you grow up? How did you grow up? Do you have brothers, sisters, rich, poor?
I would say we were lower middle class.
Okay.
So I didn't grow up poor. My parents actually, I grew up in Greenville, South Carolina. It's not too far from where I live now. And my parents at the time owned a business, and they were successful with it in the beginning. And they even bought out some of their partners that they had in the beginning, But then my mother is a very giving person. So she loves to take care of people and she has a hard time saying no. And so where that becomes a problem is when you have a business where you have certain budgets that you have and you really can't exceed those unless you increase the cost for people. She actually owned a daycare center. So the employees obviously were being paid a certain amount of an hourly. But if they'd come and ask her, you know, for a raise, she would give it to them. And so it got to the point where the payroll was so high that it wasn't being able to be supported by the income. And then the state of South Carolina, you know, changed some things and about being able to now accept K-3. And so that was a big component of their business, was doing a lot of these pre-K programs. And they also changed classroom ratios for infants. And so that, of course, affected some things there. So it kind of got out of balance. And probably after about, I don't know, they were probably into it for about maybe 13, 14 years, somewhere around in there. Wow. They ended up closing the doors on that. But I always have grown up, I grew up in a family that, you know, they've always had a business of some form or fashion, right? And I never really ever remember a time where I was not taken care of. And sometimes probably, you know, my mom would probably over leverage a credit card just to not make sure we had a good Christmas or something like that, you know, sure. Even though, you know, it's not always about, you know, just the things, but everybody has a different love language, right? And my mom's love language is she loves to provide and she loves to give things. She's a very big gifter, right? And, you know, and she, for example, you know, she knows that, you know, like I've done really well financially, but, you know, one year for Christmas recently, she gave me a $50 bill, you know? And I'm like, Mom, I don't need cash. Like, I mean, right. That's nice, but you don't need to do that. Right. But because she gave me that, I specifically took that money and went and bought something and then told her what I bought. Right. So she knew what she was actually getting for me with that money. But you know, I grew up with an older brother and an older sister and then a younger sister. So I was the third child in our family of six, but the four children.
Sure. So how old were you when that business closed down?
I was already out of the house when it closed down.
You were out of the house. You were in chiropractic school or?
No, I think I was an undergrad when it went
undergrad. Okay. Because you grew up with them always having a business. So you've got that, you see that entrepreneurial, you know, thing from them managing the business. But had you been young and seen that close down, that may have formed, you know, a little bit of fear. You were old enough that you had already kind of made up your mind that you were going to be a business guy.
Yeah. And I've actually, over the last couple of years, been kind of picking my parents' brain about that business, you know, just asking like, hey, what could you have done differently? Or, you know, what do you think really was the cause? And, you know, there's just kind of getting into their head about what really was it that caused that business to fail. And so I've been able to learn a lot of things about what they did wrong to be able to help mitigate down that debt into the future as well, especially working with people. You know, right. My mom is a very good people person and she's really good about, you know, managing people. And so I've been able to, you know, call her up and say, hey, I got this particular situation happening, you know, give me your thoughts on it. Right. And so it's good to have people like that as like a sounding board, if you will, too.
Absolutely. So, talk about, you know, when you were a child, did you ever think to yourself, I'm going to be successful? Did you ever visualize that or did that come later in life?
Well, I don't know. It's hard because I don't really ever remember thinking that, because I mean, even right now, you know, I've been asked, you know, like, you know, you have plenty to be able to just do nothing the rest of your life and just go play golf all day long or, you know, go fishing every day. But, you know, I feel like, I think I was put into this world for a reason and I don't feel like I'm done yet. Right. And as long as I continue to have the energy to be able to push forward, to me, it's not ever been a matter of, you know, trying to get a certain amount of money, because I truly enjoy the pursuit of like the process, right?
The journey, right? The journey is amazing.
is like allows me to wake up every day.
Exactly. That's where you get charged up and, you know, where the energy and the juices are flowing, you know, trying to do something you haven't done before. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of people that they did have like a vision for themselves, and maybe it changed over time, you know, but you know, what at some point in their life, you know, whether it was early childhood or later on, they visualized some, you know, success, and this is how it looked like at first, and then they chased it, you know, in doing so, there's some sacrifices and there's some challenges, but you know, they had their eye on the prize. And then again, sometimes that changes. Like, so maybe in the beginning it's I want financial freedom and, you know, I want to be able to golf every day. But then as you get older and it's more about, you know what, I want to impact more people. And, you know, I don't want to just sit on the couch. I want to impact more people. So talk about the power of networking.
Well, I mean, I oddly enough, you might not think this, Darren, but I'm a fairly introverted person when it comes to events.
Are you really?
Yes. And what I like to do is, and to mitigate that, because like if it was me, if I go to an event, I will sit at a table. I'm not the type of person who's going to go up to somebody and start talking to them or anything like that. I'm not an icebreaker type of person. I will sit in the back of the room and wait for someone to come up to me. That's kind of how I like to operate. I call it reverse networking. to really allow reverse networking to work, you have to do a lot of things before you go to that event. Like for me, it was, you know, with the MFIN and being on podcasts and, you know, doing a lot of the things that we do from a educational perspective. When you go to an event like that, people already know who I am, right? They already, you know, want to come up to me. They already want to talk to me. And so I like that better, where I can just go to an event and, you know, sometimes it's hard because you can, it's hard to go to the bathroom without getting stopped three or four times. It's like, I really need to go to the bathroom. You know? let me come back and we'll talk some more. But, you know, I prefer that kind of networking. So when it comes to true networking, where you're actually going up to people and introducing yourself and things like that, I've just never been a big fan of it myself. And like I said, I'm fairly introverted when it comes to that kind of a situation, where if I'm in an unknown, you know, conference or event or something like that, or even if I'm invited to speak on the stage, I'd rather just go to my room, you know, and, you know, get some more work done, if you will, or something like that. But I have learned to enjoy the reverse networking side of things and really being able to learn more about other people. But I still prefer them to come up to me versus the other way around.
Isn't that funny? I mean, it's like, you know, I'm 50. I don't know how old you are, but like life doesn't really change so much. You know, I try to tell my kids, you know, when you go into school, be the first one to smile at somebody walking by. Or when you sit down in class for the first time, you know, sit down and look at the person next to you and say hello, because they're thinking the same darn thing as you. They're nervous. They don't know what to say. They don't know if you're going to like them or not. And everybody has that anxiety. And so here we are, grown adults, and people want to get involved in, you know, investing. And when they first get involved, they're scared to go up and talk to people. You know, there's, you know, whether it's at a meetup group, a free meetup group, or whether they attend a conference. And correct me if I'm wrong, but what I learned is if you actually go up and talk to people, they are so open to helping you. Like, this is one industry that is so giving, you know, the people above you are willing to help the guy below. And it's not like there's a lot of competition to win deals for sure. Right. But in terms of educating people and just being friendly to people, people help each other. And so, you know, just have the courage to go up and introduce yourself, and then it'll just blossom from there.
Yeah, it's I know that that's a good thing to do, and I've forced myself to do that in many, many different environments. I just don't like to do it. I'm sure most people don't like to do it. Like,
right.
You know, failure, you know, but you got to have to force yourself to do that and kind of push yourself in that position. And most people, like you said, I mean, they want to have a conversation with you. They actually probably were more scared than you were to introduce themselves to you, you know?
Right. I think it's great to have the listeners here. Here's a guy who, you know, he's a general partner in 2,700 units. He's got $350 million in assets, you know, that he's managing. He's also in 28 other deals with 5,700 units as a limited partner. And he's still like, all right, well, when somebody comes talk to me, I'm, you know, but like, I, you know, like it's just people, like we're all nervous, you know, until you make that first move, you know? So, hey, talk about, if you do want to get involved, you know, you mentioned a little bit before, I think there's two different types of people, right, that want to get involved in real estate investing. There's some that, hey, I don't really want to and go out and find the deal and all that, but I do know that I don't want to have all my money in the stock market. I want to diversify. I want to get involved in real estate. I've heard about this passive investing thing. I've heard about having multiple income streams and how that's beneficial, but I really don't know how to do it. So that's, you know, kind of the passive person that just wants to stay passive. And then there's other investors that, you know, want to start out as passive, but their end goal is that they want to become syndicators. So with those two paths, like how do they get involved? You know, how do they get started? What's your perspective?
Well, I think from, you're talking more from a passive perspective or active?
So first, you know, is just a guy that just wants to be passive, completely passive and not grow into an active role. And then secondly would be a guy who, you know, wants to start out passive to learn, but then get into more of an active role.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think the first thing for somebody is just investing as an LP, you know, whether you want to be passive or active. I mean, obviously if you want to be passive, then.
So how do they do that?
How do they invest passively?
In 47 years, okay, before I got involved in these groups, I didn't have one person introduce themselves to me and say, hey, Darren, I've got this 200 unit multifamily deal. You don't want to invest. Like yeah. Once you get into the world, and I get emails all the time now, but I didn't, you know, before 3 years ago.
Yeah, I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, self-realization of this because, I mean, even if somebody would have presented it to me 5 years ago, I probably still wouldn't have done it. But it was me now at a certain point in time and moment where I was like, I need to do something. And it was the research that I did on my own. And yes, you know, I think that you can still find people and educate them. But I think a lot of it is, like you said, just lack of knowledge that you can actually do it. Cause
right.
Even a lot of people that I meet that are not associated with our industry that now invest with us, they're like, I didn't even know you could do this. I'm like, yeah, Right. Neither did I, you know? So it's our responsibility, I think as syndicators to go out there and educate other people that really have no clue about what we're doing. And that is a uphill battle actually to try to find those investors because it comes across more salesy, right? Like, how are you going to attract those people? Because you could put an ad in the New York Times or you could run an ad on the television to be able to find those new investors. But it's so unknown that the easiest type of investor to it actually come into your fold is somebody who realized it on their own, did some research, and then they found you because of that. Right. And that's why it's important to be on, you know, podcasts like this and, you know, be on other people's podcasts and be able to have an educational platform because at any point in time, there's going to be somebody that's looking into this industry. And if you are the one teaching them, guess what? You're the expert and you're the authority. You're the authority figure in the industry as well.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great point. So I think, you know, listeners, you know, first thing is determine what markets you want to be invested in, you know, and then in those markets, find syndicators, you know, and start to reach out to them. And you can do that through, you know, now you have so many different options. You've got all these multifamily Facebook groups. You've got, you know, social media. You've got conferences. You've got this Multifamily Investor Nation Summit, you know, so there's so many different ways to meet who the syndicators are that are putting these deals together. But you, the difference between investing in, you know, IBM stock is you could actually call, you know, Dan, you know, you could actually talk to the syndicators that are doing the deal and see if there's somebody that kind of fits your fold and who you want to do business with.
Yeah, it's definitely a relationship business. So, you know, as you're getting started, go out there. You know, I think what you said, Darren, is very important about picking your markets, because there's a lot of syndicators, not a lot. There's a few syndicators out there that I really want to invest with, but they invest in markets that I don't want to be in. And right. So I have a certain set of number of markets that I really like and certain ones that I don't like. And if they go to acquire a property in a market that I don't like, I still don't invest with them, right? Because I think there's a certain hierarchy of, you know, what's the most important, right? And I think one of the most important pieces is the market itself, because if a market doesn't have stability, I don't care how good of a syndicator you have, the market starts to go down, the syndicator really can't do anything about the market conditions. So the market really is kind of that number one thing. And then finding, like you said, that operator, that sponsor, that syndicator that can actually execute on the business plan the way it is actually presented, and that they actually have some extra room in there for error and they have some extra buffer. But one of the things I do for myself when I'm investing passively is I tell myself that if I invest passively in this deal, if I can cut the returns that are being projected in half, would I still be happy with the returns? And so I lower my expectations on that particular offering. So they tell me I'm going to get 15-20%. I drop that down and I'll say, all right, 7.5-10% is what I'm looking for on that particular deal. And because I know that things don't go as exactly as planned, but if they can execute and still only get 50% of the return, I'm going to still be happy. Then I'll likely invest. But I actually, wrote an article recently on the 5 red flags of passive apartment investing, and I think you actually have it on our website. You can go there and find it there as well. In that knowledge center at passiveinvesting.com. And you'll see some of the things that I look for as an LP as to what I'm going to invest, the type of sponsor that I'm going to invest in and what I'm not.
Oh, that's awesome. It's fantastic that you have all this free information for new people. So definitely take advantage of that, guys. So what do you do for fun outside of real estate?
So, well, I enjoy right now spending a lot of time with the kids, with the family, because we have 4 children. So we have
actually that will keep you busy.
It will, especially because they used to be all under 10. And then last week I had my oldest turn 10. So we have a 10-year-old girl, an 8-year-old boy, a 4-year-old girl, and a 2-year-old girl.
Wow.
So life is very busy when it comes to that. But then we're playing a lot of sports with them. Like my son's doing soccer right now. And so is my daughter. She's doing my older daughter. She's doing soccer. And he's involved with a lot of sports. They also are involved with a lot of music. So they both play instruments. My brother, my son plays the cello as well as the piano. And my older daughter plays the violin as well as the piano as well. So I'm definitely busy with that side of things. But I also enjoy a nice game of golf, but I also enjoy racquetball. I don't know if everybody plays racquetball over there.
Racquetball, that's old school.
It is. I love it, though. It's a very fast-paced game.
Yeah.
I'm a very fast-paced type person. I'll go out there and play for 2 hours, at a time, try to get out there, a couple times a week. So
nice. And well, I'll definitely play golf with you. Racquetball, maybe, maybe not. but I also saw a while ago you posted something about, I don't know if you still have it, but a motorcycle. And if we're gonna have to figure out a way to get out and ride together at some point too. I don't have a bike, but I recently went down to Austin to meet with some other investors, and I decided, you know what? I've been wanting to ride for a while. Like, I just rented a Harley and drove down, and it was awesome. So do you still have the bike?
I do. It's actually an interesting story, because my dad, all he rides and drives now is a motorcycle. He's ever since I've known
really?
Him, all he's done is a motorcycle. And he drives it to work and back to work, rain, sleet, snow, it doesn't matter what it is. He's a diehard like biker, and he's a big Honda enthusiast. So he has a Honda PC, a Pacific Coast 800, and he's had a couple of them over the years, and he's had a couple of accidents, but he just gets right back up and goes and starts playing again. One of the most recent accidents he had, some lady pulled out of a gas station and almost pretty much T-boned him, and shattered his tibia in his leg, and he had to have rods and stitches and pins put in there. And I remember going to the hospital when he was there, and I was like, I leaned over to him, and I was like, Dad, I think this is the Lord telling you that you need to give up the motorcycle. He leaned forward a little bit further and goes, no, I think he's just telling me I need to be more careful.
That's great. Do you guys ride together?
Well, we do ride together, but the bike that I have right now, so I don't actually have a bike that's my own. So the bike I have now, my brother passed away a few years ago, and he had a BC 800. And so my dad, his wife gave it to my dad, and my dad has it in my house right now. And I was like, well, I'm going to get my license again and start driving it around. So I do enjoy getting out there and riding the bike. And I think if I can convince my wife, I will eventually get an actual bike for myself. But right now I'm just so busy as it is that, I don't really have a lot of time to get out there and probably have as much fun with it as I can. But we also have some four wheelers. My son and I will get out in the backyard and ride some four wheelers a little bit. And back in August of this year, we actually bought an airplane, a little single engine Cirrus.
Really? How to fly?
I'm learning it. So I started about 10 years ago before when I was finishing up my last year in chiropractic college and had about 65 hours of flying, almost did my check ride. And then that's when I moved to South Carolina after going to school for a while and then started a family and stuff like that. So life got busy. But then back in August of this year, decided to buy one, mostly because of COVID, because all the stuff that was happening there. And I was like, I want to be able to fly wherever I want to fly and get to wherever I want to go. And so now we can use it to, tour properties really quickly and come all back in one day and stuff like that too. So
That's funny. So you've accomplished so much and you're a leader in the space. What's the big stretch goal for you right now?
Well, right now we're on track and on par to try to get to $1 billion in assets under management. So that's kind of the goal.
$1 billion.
Yep. Yeah. We have a 5-year goal. This year was definitely taken down a little bit from COVID. So our goal was to take down about $300 million in acquisitions. And we're right at that $170 million mark right now for the year, which is where we'll probably end up.
Wow. So $1 billion in assets by when?
So in the next 3 years.
3 years. And right now you're at $350 million. So, that is awesome. It's like, when I talk to one interviewer after another guest, and it's like when they start reaching a goal, they just up the ante. And that goes back to what we were talking about before, is because the journey is really where it's nice getting the prize, and it's nice getting the prize, but it's really the journey that charges you up and is where all the energy is that, can I accomplish this, and how do I do it? So how do the listeners reach out to you if they want to, reach out to you, Dan?
Sure. So I would say that there's three easy ways to do that. So first off, you can go to passiveinvesting.com and you can go on the top right-hand corner of the page. And there's a link there that says, join the Passive Investor Club. You can fill out that form, jump on a phone call with you one-on-one, discuss your investment goals, see if we're a good fit. And if you're wanting to learn more about multifamily, I'm more on the active side, but even if you're a passive investor, you can learn more about what happens on the active side. You can go to multifamilyinvestornation.com and sign up for our free weekly email that we send out about our webinar announcement. And then the third way is LinkedIn. So I'm on LinkedIn. So you can go to LinkedIn, just type in my name, Dan Hanford, and you can find me there, connect with me. We'd love to, be able to connect with you and learn more about you, but also have you learn more about some of the stuff that we're working on as well.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you coming on. It's gone full circle. I appreciate you, bringing me on as a first guest a long time ago after I got my first deal. And, I applaud all your success and look to learn more and more from you and your team. Listeners, I hope that you enjoyed that one. Until next week, signing off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.